This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
Nangi said six people had been reported dead and hundreds of suspected cholera sufferers were still in villages around Idabatu.
That's Moki Edwin Kinzaka reporting. Details coming up. Also, a law has been passed in Sudan that will dismantle the foundations of former President Omar al-Bashir's government. And in Namibia, voters continue to wait for results in the country's election. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, Sudan's transitional government overturned a moral policing law that criminalized certain clothing for women and drinking alcohol. It also moved to dissolve the country's former ruling party, carrying out two key demands of Sudan's pro-democracy protesters. Michael Atit reports from Khartoum.
Sudan's Justice Minister Nasreddin Abdulbari says abolishing the Public Order Act and disbanding the National Congress Party is, in his words, a big achievement for Sudan's revolution. Speaking in Arabic, Abdulbari says many Sudanese families have been subjected to beatings, harassment, and even imprisonment under the Public Order Act.
The first law simply, it abolishes all the Public Order Act, which we are all aware that it has oppressed many families in Sudan, and specifically the vulnerable groups. Some of them have experiences that are horrible to hear during the implementation period.
Abdulbari says 11 members of the Sovereign Council and 23 members of the cabinet voted to suspend the National Congress Party and to freeze all of their assets.
This law is meant to fragment the National Congress Party specifically, which will allow the government to confiscate and apprehend all financial assets and property which have been owned by the party and divert them to the account of the Ministry of Finance.
Rights groups say the Public Order Act targets women and is an outdated law left over from the 30-year rule of ousted President Omar al-Bashir. Speaking in Arabic, Khartoum resident Mashair Ramadan says the action proves that the transitional government is serious about carrying out reforms.
I regard this move as the first positive step towards building a civilian government in Sudan. This will reform a lot in our society to provide the basic human rights and lift the oppression from citizens. This is a good step, but we are still waiting for more so that we feel that our revolution has won.
Rights activist and Khartoum resident Amira Osman Hamid says while overturning the Public Order Act is a good thing, other provisions in Sudan criminal code should be abolished, which is still allow authorities to oppress women.
For me, I don't think this law has been abolished because articles from 152 to 155 of Sudan's criminal act still exist, and they could be using them to oppress and violate human rights. So I don't think anything has been changed.
Yesterday, a group of Sudanese women activists in Khartoum also say that abolishing the Public Order Act does not alone solve the problem facing women in the country. Article 24.3 of the constitutional document states that until the Legislative Council is formed, the Council's powers are invested in the members of the Sovereign Council and the Cabinet, who exercises them in a joint meeting and take decisions by consensus or a two-thirds majority of members. This is the first joint meeting of both councils to make decisions over the country's laws since the formation of the Sovereign Council more than 3 months ago. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
Cameroonian health and emergency personnel are working to stem a cholera outbreak that has killed a dozen people and sickened at least 100 others in the Bakassi Peninsula, which shares a maritime boundary with Nigeria. It is feared the outbreak will claim more lives in the coastal area, which lacks health infrastructure. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Idabato that while waiting for medication to fight the cholera bacteria, military and health staff are teaching residents ways to improve hygiene and sanitation.
Emergency medical workers, together with some civilians, cleared dirt and debris from water beneath houses on the shores of Cameroon's Bakassi Peninsula. Among them is 31-year-old Cameroonian fisherman Lucas Emimu, who says he lost his younger sister to cholera. Emimu says he has joined the humanitarian workers because he fears many more people may die from the infectious disease that causes severe watery diarrhea, leading to dehydration and even death if untreated.
We lack toilets, portable water. There's no hospital. People defecate beside the sea, under the houses, everywhere. And so it makes the place not good to stay.
Dr. Ebongo Zacchaeus Nanje, the area's top health official, says humanitarian workers were deployed when news broke that people were dying and some were being rushed to hospitals. He says there is no doubt cholera is to blame.
Upon the reception of a distress signal from our team in the Bakassi Health District, we came down to Idabato, myself and the entire emergency response team. The situation on the ground really sends a pointer to the fact that we are in an outbreak of cholera.
Nanji said 6 people had been reported dead and hundreds of suspected cholera sufferers were still in villages around Idabato. Civilians said they had buried 6 others before the medical team's arrival. The actual death toll could be higher because many live in remote locations, complicating efforts to get accurate health data. Nanji urged people to be vigilant and report any cholera symptoms. But the government says only 20% of the population visits hospitals. Most of them prefer traditional African medicine. Some complain that the only government hospital in Idabato is understaffed and lacks medication. Roland Ewane, a top Cameroonian official in Idabato, says Nigerians living in the region prefer to return to their country for health care, making the journey reduces chances of survival for cholera patients.
We have a population of about 40,000. They are mostly Nigerians. We have been carrying out sensitization campaign on the necessity of using, the importance of using government services. One of them is the hospital. They don't come to the hospital. It's a big cry.
The Bakassi Peninsula is by the sea, but potable water is hard to find. Few have toilets, and the local hospital struggles to handle epidemics. Nigeria ceded full control of the Bakassi Peninsula to Cameroon in 2013, in keeping with a 2002 International Court of Justice ruling. Some 300,000 Nigerians live on the peninsula, approximately 90% of its population. The territory is rich in hydrocarbons and fisheries, but lacks basic social services. Most health workers trained by Nigeria to serve in the area returned to their country when Cameroon did not continue paying their salaries. Some also fled attacks by separatists fighting for the independence of Cameroon's English-speaking regions from the French-speaking majority. Cameroon has faced difficulties replacing departed medical staff. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Idabato, southwestern Cameroon.
Voters in Namibia continue to wait for results in the country's election. Namibians went to the polls on Wednesday to elect a president and legislators after years of economic hardship and a recent corruption scandal that have stirred up resentment against the government. The Southwest Africa People's Party, SWAPO, headed by President Hage Geingob, has ruled the Southwest African country since independence from South Africa in 1990. Now, President Geingob faces a strong challenge from fellow ruling party member running as an independent, Panduli Itula. The breakaway candidate is particularly popular among youths frustrated by the lack of jobs and too young to remember the SWAPO-led war for independence. According to the Electoral Commission of Namibia, with roughly a fourth of the Southern African nation's constituencies counted, Geingob and SWAPO held 55.8% of the vote. His strongest challenger, independent Pandulini Itula, had 21.4% of the votes cast, while the third-place candidate, Bernardus Swartbui of the Landless People's Movement, was at 7.9%. You're listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Sixteen past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Sudanese authorities have approved a law to dismantle the foundations of former President Omar al-Bashir's government. Cameroon is working to stem a cholera outbreak that has killed at least a dozen people and sickened at least 100. And vote counting is still underway in Namibia. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. World AIDS Day, the annual event to raise awareness of the global epidemic, turns 31 December 1st. However, as longevity, treatment, and access to care improve worldwide, the United Nations Children's Fund is sounding the alarm, reporting that more than 300 children die every day of AIDS-related causes. UNICEF is urging young people to get earlier testing and treatment. In Johannesburg, VOA's Anita Powell met with some of the now-grown children who have survived to talk about the struggles they overcame.
Jane Mabasa was just 9 years old when she was separated from her ill mother and brought to this AIDS hospice in Johannesburg. At the time, South Africa's health system was in deep denial about the epidemic, and global AIDS fatalities were more than three times what they are today. Before she arrived at the Sparrow Village AIDS Hospice, more than 7,000 children had died, at the alarming rate of 9 deaths each week. She was sick, skinny, and alone, and sure she would join their ranks. In fact, she said, she wanted to.
I was very sick to such an extent that, you know, the only thing that could give me peace was to die. So when I was 14 years old, that's when they started explaining to me that this is what's happening. And you were born with this disease and you have to accept it and you just have to live with it.
That's what she did. Today, she's 22, on treatment and healthy. Since 2003, only one child has died of AIDS-related causes here, turning this hospice into a house of hope. But as UNICEF reports this year, children are dying at the rate of 320 per day around the world, and about half of them are not on treatment. Those are alarming statistics, because with early intervention and treatment, HIV-positive patients can live long, healthy lives. Dr. Chua Luo heads the HIV-AIDS section at UNICEF. Luo, a pediatrician, says healthcare providers need to treat HIV as a family matter.
Children are falling behind the treatment drive globally. And today we're talking about 54% of children accessing treatment. About half of children are accessing treatment. Mortality in this age group is still high. But there's also the aspect that if we are treating adults, we need to change the way we deliver services. For every adult that's accessing treatment, are we really asking about the children?
And the fight is about more than just medicine, says Nomphumelelo Madonsela, who works with young people in Johannesburg for a healthcare organization focused on HIV and AIDS. She spends her days tracking down youth who may have defaulted on their treatment. Even in 2009, she says, youth awareness is an issue.
People think that once I get tested, I'll know the status, and if I'm positive, then I'll just die. So if I don't know, I'm not gonna die. So I think it's about them. To them, what you don't know won't kill you.
20-year-old Johanna Mohotsi, who was born with the virus and abandoned as a baby at the hospice, only started treatment last year when her white cell count dipped below a certain point. She says the people who helped her most in her journey were the children around her.
They made me understand that it's not the end of the world when you drink medication. They actually reminded me to take my pills every day. They told me everything about their experiences through HIV and AIDS. So for me, it was nothing serious because I thought it was something like that it can be cured, knowing that they're taking the medications and they're still healthy.
Mohotsi now dreams of becoming a nurse, and Mabasa is on the board of the home she thought would be her last. Both know that mother-to-child transmission of the virus is now preventable and is a pillar of the strategy against pediatric HIV. And Mohotsi says she wants to have children someday. Mabasa, however, says the psychological trauma of her own chronic illness makes her shun motherhood. But she loves kids, she says, and wishes she could go back and talk to her younger self.
I'm proud of the 9-year-old Jane because she had to accept that it is what it is. And I believe that I was born with dreams. I have my dreams and I made sure that HIV and AIDS will not take those dreams away from me.
Instead, she says it to the children who continue to come through here, expecting to live long, healthy lives. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Botswana is battling a sharp rise in wildlife poaching, with rhinos particularly targeted. Almost 2 rhinos are poached every month, which conservationists say could lead to the extinction of the endangered black rhino by 2021. From Habrone, Botswana, Mokandisi Dube reports.
Botswana has an estimated rhino population of 400, but the species are increasingly facing an uncertain future in the country. Poachers have killed 14 rhinos since April, meaning nearly 2 animals are poached every month. Conservationists say it is time for a robust strategy to save the endangered animals. Map Ives of the Rhino Conservation Botswana says the killing of rhinos is concerning and says the anti-poaching units lack the resources to fight the rise in poaching.
And given that our forces, the BDF and the anti-poaching forces of the DWNP, are short of equipment, mostly vehicles and aircraft, we will continue to do what we can with what we have, but it is a definitely an alarming situation.
Ives says the country cannot afford to lose any more rhinos given their low numbers.
We have lost a total of 17 animals in the last calendar year, that is 12 months. And against the population of black rhinos, this is really very, very serious.
Neil Feet of the Kalahari Conservation Society says the government should involve wildlife conservation groups more in the fight against poaching.
Poaching and illegal wildlife trade very much is in the hands of the government in Botswana. Some countries, they do allow NGOs in that space, and they can help, could open up a bit more and allow players in.
The government acknowledges the dire situation and says poaching is putting considerable pressure on the black rhino population. The Botswana government says it is escalating its efforts with the deployment of more anti-poaching units, particularly in the vast Okavango Delta, where most rhinos are found. There are only 4,200 black rhinos living in the world. Rhino horn, which is used in some Asian traditional medicines, sells for thousands of dollars on the black market, and poaching is pushing the species towards extinction. For VOA News, this is Mkondisi Dube in Habrone, Botswana.
A high-ranking UN official says that while Zimbabwe's growing food insecurity situation has been caused by a number of factors, including a devastating drought, it's also partly man-made. Reporter Kudzai Zanawash has more.
Hilal Elva is the UN Special Rapporteur on the Right for Food. She just wrapped up a 10-day visit to Zimbabwe at a time when millions of people are suffering from food insecurity. She highlights some of the key issues she has observed while compiling a report on the food security situation with a focus on human rights.
Man-made starvation is slowly making its way in Zimbabwe. That's a very serious situation. More than 60% of the population of the country, once seen as the breadbasket of Africa, is now considered food insecure, with most households unable to obtain enough food to meet basic needs due to hyperinflation.
She calls the starvation man-made because of poor management of land and resources in recent years. She adds that about 5.5 million rural residents face starvation as poor rains and erratic weather affect their harvests. She says many more are affected in the cities.
In urban areas, an estimated 2.2 million people are food insecure and lack access to minimum public services, including health, electricity, and safe water. These are shocking figures, and the crisis continues to worsen due to poverty and high unemployment, widespread corruption, severe price instabilities, lack of purchasing power, poor agricultural activity, natural disasters, recurrent drought, and economic sanctions.
She adds that women and children are most at the receiving end of this crisis. She says the bulk of the populace is not eating frequently enough and getting nutritious meals, something that will have a long-term effect.
Zimbabwe counts among the four highest food insecure states in the world, alongside conflict-ravaged countries, which there is no conflict in Zimbabwe. I call on the government of Zimbabwe to live up to its zero hunger commitment. This is a global commitment from every country without any discrimination.
Elva says she presented her findings to government.
Government reaction actually is very positive. They accepted all these serious issues that what is happening in rural areas and the cities. It is almost impossible not to see anyway. Obviously, they are very much aware. They try to do their best, but still they have to do something more.
Elva says the international community should intervene before a conflict evolves from the crisis. Part of her recommendations include removing all economic sanctions on Zimbabwe to give the country a chance to rebuild. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashe from Harare.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the sunny side of sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in. You will be glad you did. I guarantee it.
Music time in Africa. Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Friday at 0900 and Saturday and Sunday at 0900, 15, 20, and 2200 hours UTC.